Let's turn, please, to Luke chapter 7. Luke chapter 7, we're looking at the dead man raised. Luke 7, 1 through 17. We'll simply caption it very simply, a dead man raised. Luke chapter 7, verses 11 through 17. And I'll put in parentheses next to a dead man raised, 3. Because we have 3 recorded instances in the Gospels of a dead man being raised, or a dead person, we should say, being raised. There are 2 in the Old Testament and 3 in the Gospels, and we're looking at one of those 3. And in reading through the section, let's break it down into 4 parts. Reading the text, first, the transition. This will be the outline we'll be following and studying it. First, the transition, verse 11. It came about soon afterwards that he, Jesus, went to a city called Nain, and his disciples were going along with him, accompanied by a large multitude. And that's the transition from the preceding text into this event. Beginning with verse 12, you have the meeting that takes place along the way. Now, as he approached the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out, the only son of his mother. And she was a widow, and a sizable crowd from the city was with her. That is the meeting. Then in verses 13, 14, and 15, we have the miracle. 13, and when the Lord saw her, he felt compassion for her and said to her, "Do not weep." And he came up and touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt. And he said, "Young man, I say to you, arise." And the dead man sat up, began to speak, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. And then finally, the impact, fourth part, verses 16 and 17. Fear gripped them all. And they began glorifying God, saying, "A great prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people." And this report concerning him went out over all Judea and all the surrounding districts. So under those 4 points then, let's outline the raising of the dead man, Luke 7, 1 through 11, number 1, the transition. Transition from the preceding event to this one, 7:11. Several things. First, what is the relationship of this event to what goes before? Whenever we move from one event to another, obviously the question rises, why did Luke put this here? And as you open, notice coming into verse 11 that it occurred very soon after this. And that's found in the words, well translated by New American Standard Bible, that says, "And it came about soon afterwards." Obviously the question would be, how soon? Well, if we take the word that is translated soon here and look at it elsewhere, usually it means the next day. So we can at least surmise that it reads something like this. In the preceding day, he had perceived the faith of the centurion. Jesus had remarked about it, and there took place a healing of his son who was about to die. And then with verse 11, it came about soon afterwards, parenthesis, perhaps and probably on the next day. Notice again in relationship of these 2 events, another important thing, however, is mentioned. And the first is this. Both events, that's in 7, 1 through 10, both events pertain to death. 7, 1 through 10 speaks of the healing of one involved in death, and now another. Both events in 1 through 10 and 11 through 17 pertain to death. The difference is this. In the first event, is 7, 1 through 10. Notice in verse 2, a certain centurion slave who was highly regarded by him was sick and about to die. In the first, the words are about to die. In the second event, the one we're looking at tonight, which also pertains to death, Notice the wording that you find down in verse 12. Now as he, Jesus, approached the gate of the city, behold, a dead man. So, two expressions. The first, about to die. In the second, the man was dead. Now why do you think Luke would put those two things together? Makes sense, doesn't it? We have learned gradually, we've learned from the event with the centurion servant that was about to die, that the Lord can keep from death. I wonder if perhaps he is also Lord over death. And Luke says, that's the point I want to make. I want to point out not only that the Lord can keep men from death, but he can bring men out of death. And so the sequence is, as far as teaching is concerned, the sequence is the Lord is sovereign in keeping from and raising out of. Let's just put keeping from and over. Use those two prepositions. Keeping from and over death. And so they come together sort of as a little 1-2 punch with the second one building and developing beyond the idea that is found in the first one. Another comparison that we could make between these two events and explaining why they are set side by side is simply this. In the first instance, the Lord heals or keeps him from death from a distance and with a word. In the second, he is present with death, and once again, it is with a word. By the way, all three of the healings, or not healings, all three of the raisings from the dead in the ministry of Jesus were with a word. He did not touch, he touched the coffin, but he did not touch. It was always with a word in each one of these three circumstances. Now, if we can set a little bit of the physical scene, notice coming to chapter 7 and verse 11, it came about soon afterwards that he went to a city called Nain. The city of Nain is still in Israel. You can visit the city of Nain. City, not a city by our terms, but a small town. And basically the town that is there today is the same that was there then. The name Nain is associated with a Hebrew word that means pleasant. And it's a very apt description because located at Nain, you could look north. And as you look north, you saw Mount Tabor, beautiful mountain. And if you look to the southeast, you saw Mount Gilboa, which was also beautiful. So picture a very beautiful city that looks to the north and to the south. You see the beautiful mountains that are there, the lush type thing. And you have a very picturesque city in Israel. And therefore, as they come into Nain, their funeral procession is coming out of the city. Nain was located so it had only one entrance. Only one way you could get in. And it still exists today, the same way in and out. By Jewish custom, you never buried within a Jewish city. So obviously, the group is coming out. They would be headed for Endor. Endor was about a 10-minute walk from Nain. Endor, you can still see tombs carved in the rocks. Endor is still a place of burial. It's an active cemetery yet today. And therefore, when you come in the situation of chapter 7, Jesus is going to break up the procession and he's going to perform a raising from the dead. As a matter of fact, this event right here, many places in Palestine that are described biblically, you're not sure where they are. The tomb of Jesus. You're shown one by a bus station, and as you back off and look at it, they call it Golgotha, the place of the skull, and you can see it looks like a skull. But that's not for sure. So we can't nail down many places to the exact spot. If you ever visit there, they will tell you it is the exact spot. As a matter of fact, there's one place where you have a footmark as though it's been pushing off, and that's where Jesus launched the ascension. So you're told. But nonetheless, many of the other place that is pretty locatable is Bethlehem. Pretty much go right to where the down in the church, down in the grotto. You can go pretty much to, this is probably the place that that Jesus was actually born. This is another one of those places. Not only can you go to the city, but you can go on the same path on which the processions met. And you can go, who knows how far out it was, but you can go from the city gate where the processional had passed and where they had met Jesus, and you could pretty much come not only to the city, but you can also see the very path on which these two groups met, which is here. And what is going to happen, if you can visualize it, picture a funeral procession coming out. The mother would be leading the bier or the casket, and there was a large group with them. There's a large group with Jesus, and the two groups meet. So we come then down to the meeting. Transition, and now the meeting. 7:12. And that verse breaks into two easy parts. Number one, the dead man. Number two, the widow mother. First, the dead man. 7:12a. Now, when I read through this, I did not really read through it correctly, but verse 12 is meant in this way, and the way it's structured, it conveys the meaning that the group with Jesus, the disciples in the crowd, was walking along. And all of a sudden, somebody says, "Look!" And that is the force of the word "behold." And I know "behold" is not like shouting out "look," but that's exactly what the word means. It comes from a verb that means to see. And therefore, Luke intends in verse 12 to picture drama. It's a marking off a meeting with the word to rivet attention. And so think of excitement, and please rivet your attention. So verse 12, as he approached the gate of the city, look, and that's the force of it. Look, a dead man was being carried out. Obviously, the processional was coming out of the city because of Jewish regulations. You could not bury the dead among the living, and therefore you had to take them outside of the city, which is here. And at that point, the group with Jesus, including the disciples in the crowd, they meet. So, first, the meeting was not fortuitous. The meeting was not fortuitous. It was not a chance meeting. Now, from a Christian standpoint, that is always, always very important to recognize, that God is in control of the events of life, and many things that we will call mere circumstances are not. And as we look at this meeting of Jesus with the funeral procession, should we just say, "Well, what a coincidence I met you here." Much like you go to the grocery store and you meet someone you haven't seen for a long time. And you take it as what? Just a coincidence. We didn't plan to meet here. There was no planning involved whatsoever. It just happened to be that you were in the store and I was in the store at the same time. And it was truly just chance. Now, as Christians, we shouldn't look at things that way. Now, that doesn't mean that everything that happens to us we have to assign some reason to. If you do that, you become crazy or a nut of some sort, trying to assign a reason as to why you had a flat tire on the freeway at 4 o'clock in the morning Tuesday. Probably not much significance to it at all. And yet, at the same time, from a Christian standpoint, we learn from Scripture that meetings often are not chance. And let me give you a few examples of it. First, Genesis 22. So I think this incident here is not fortuitous, meaning the Lord planned it this way. It's part of God's working that the processional and Jesus would meet at this time. And let me give you some examples of what we would probably call chance, but they were not. And the first, we're looking at the case of Abraham in chapter 22, verse 13. And let me give you the background. Abraham has been told to take Isaac and slay him. And the event is about to take place. Notice verse 10. Abraham stretched out his hand, took the knife to slay his son. So if you can see the lifted hand to make the sacrifice of Isaac. And at that moment, the angel of the Lord called him from heaven and said, Abraham, Abraham. And he said, here am I. And he said, do not stretch out your hand against the lad. Do nothing to him, for now I know that you fear me, since you have not withheld your son, your only son, from me. And is this fortuitous, or is this part of God's provision? Then Abraham raised his eyes and looked, and behold, behind him a ram caught in the thicket by his horns. So what happened? Just at the moment he needed a sacrifice, the sacrifice was there. Coincidence? Not at all. Provision. Go over to chapter 24. And another example of something that is not mere coincidence, but is part of the sovereign plan and provision of God. Chapter 22, or rather 24. The servant of Abraham has been sent out to find a wife for Isaac. And as he arrives in Mesopotamia, he begins to pray. And so verse 12 reads, he said, O Lord, the God of my master Abraham, please grant me success today, and show loving kindness to my master Abraham. And behold, I am standing by the spring, and the daughters of the men of the city are coming out to draw water. Now may it be that the girl to whom I say, please let down your jar so that I may drink, and who answers, drink, and I will water your camels also, may she be the one to whom thou hast appointed for thy servant Isaac. And by this I shall know that thou hast shown loving kindness to my master. And it came about when he had finished speaking, behold, Rebekah comes to the well. Chance? Well, from the human standpoint, chance. From the divine standpoint, this is the planning of God. Look at the book of Ruth. Ruth. Joshua, Judges, Ruth. And we're in chapter 2. And verse 2 describes a routine event. The Jewish farmer was not to harvest all the way into the corners, but to leave some for hungry people. And that morning, Ruth got up and did the routine. She went out to gather some leavings. And so Ruth 2:2, Ruth the Moabitess said to Naomi, please let me go to the field and glean among the ears of corn after one by whose side I might find favor. And she said to her, go, my daughter. So she departed and went and gleaned in the field after the reapers. And she happened to come to the portion of the field belonging to Boaz. You know the rest of the story? Chance? Not at all. God brings two events. She goes to glean, she gets in the right field, and God works out his plan. New Testament, Acts 23. A Christian does not believe in chance. There is no such thing as good luck or good fortune, not if God is in control of his universe. Or did Ruth come home that evening and say, I happened to go into the field of Boaz, and God says, I'm shocked. You've had wonderful luck today. I didn't know that. Obviously not. He planned because he's sovereign. And in Acts chapter 23, verse 12, this is with Paul. When it was day, the Jews formed a conspiracy and bound them together under oath, saying they would neither eat or drink until they had killed Paul. And this was all secret, except, verse 16, the son of Paul's sister heard of their ambush. Was that chance? He hears of the ambush, he speaks to the centurion, and Paul is delivered. Did God bring those things together to save Paul? Absolutely. Or was this just a circumstance? The kid was nosy anyway. Did he just happen to hear of it? Or is this part of the plan of God? All right, that's enough to take it back now to Luke 7. How would you interpret verses 11 and 12? Are you going to interpret this as mere chance or sovereign plan? Verse 11, it came about soon afterwards that he went to a city called Nain, and his disciples were going along with him, accompanied by a large multitude. Now, as Jesus approached the gate of the city, behold, a dead man was being carried out. Jesus coming in, the dead man coming out. Chance? No, not at all. Plan. And therefore, the two meet at that point as part of God's plan. This is followed in the last half of the verse by something about the widow mother. Widow mother. Two things about her. And the first is found in the latter part. She was the only son of his mother. This was her only son. And she's also a widow. Now, what that means is this. And when we get to the weekend on October 11, 12, 13, and begin to talk about manhood, two of the biblical principles for manhood, two of the three ones, three principles in Scripture, and it's certainly borne out in the Old Testament, was the man was always to protect and to provide for women. Men were the protectors and providers of women, and we'll see how that is literally shot through all of Scripture in that way. A woman would have several protectors and providers. She would have her first protector and provider, which would be, in a normal situation, her father. The second protector a woman would have would be her husband. And a third would be her son. What has happened to this woman twice? She has lost her protector, provider twice. And that moved the Lord. So here's a woman, and we picture her pitiful condition. Now, when it talks about losing the only son, one of the most painful experiences spoken of in Scripture is the loss of an only child. As a matter of fact, that became a proverb for what pain was. And so if he would talk about you're experiencing pain, you would say, how bad? Well, it's like losing an only child. And that was regarded as the most painful thing that could happen to a person, and therefore it became very much a proverb for intense pain. Keep your finger here and let's see that. Jeremiah chapter 6. Jeremiah chapter 6. For a thing to become a proverb or a simile, you have to have something that happens regularly. If you said Christ was led like a lamb to a slaughter, you have to understand something about a lamb being led to slaughter. Or if he, using a rough English idiom, he's as fast as greased lightning. You know how fast lightning is, and if you can imagine it being greased, you've got enormous speed. Well, when Jeremiah talks about pain and grief, he says it's like losing an only son, and it means intense grief. Chapter 6, verse 26. He's speaking to Israel, and he says, O daughter of my people, put on sackcloth and roll in ashes. Mourn. Well, there are different degrees of mourning, are there not? Well, he wants to insist that this is the most intense kind, and therefore he uses the only son metaphor. Mourn like for an only son. And they knew that meant painful, sincere, deep, deep mourning. So this is part of the description of the widow mother. She's lost on two occasions her protector and provider, and she is experiencing the most intense pain that the Bible really knows, especially in the Old Testament, and that is the loss of an only son. Look at Luke 8, 42. The intense pain of the loss is emphasized in the healing of the daughter of the official from the synagogue, and the same expression is used of him in verse 42, for he had an only daughter. And that is intended to sharpen and intensify the pain. 9:38 of Luke, 9:38. And a special way for this man to get attention was not to say, this is my son, this is my only son. And notice the basis of his appeal. It says, verse 38, behold, a man from the multitude shouted out, saying, teacher, I beg you to look at my son. And then to add more ammunition, for he is my only son. All right, taking that back then, establishing the first point then, this is an only son. The second thing we know about her is that she was accompanied by a large crowd as she comes out of the city. There were more people at the funeral than had been expected. Or that, notice how that reads, chapter 7, verse 12. It says, she was a widow and a sizable crowd. The word sizable, Greek word hikonos, means sufficient plus. It's anything that is adequate and overflowing. Sizable helps, but there was an adequate and overflowing crowd that was coming from the city was with her. What are one of the characteristics of the miracles of Jesus? Are they done in the secret or are they done in public? You've got a mass gathering. You've got Jesus, the disciples, and a mass of people coming into the city. Coming out of the city, you've got the woman. You would have the professional mourners who would be screaming and yelling and wailing and mourning, paid to do it. And along with that, you had a great big crowd. So two crowds are going to meet. And Jesus is going to raise the boy, not secretly, but very dramatically. As the crowd comes out, he steps over and he touches the coffin. And when he touches the coffin, they stop. And you can imagine they not only stop, but they stop dead in their tracks. Can you imagine a funeral? The pallbearers are carrying the casket out. Someone in the crowd steps forward and puts their hand on the casket. And everybody stops. Got attention? Is the Lord trying to do something in secret? He's saying, dramatically, I want you to all to look. Something is about to happen. And he does that in this crowd. The position of the mother would be to lead the casket. Today we don't do that. Today, typically, at least for etiquette as far as a pastor is concerned, you stand at the head of the casket for the service and stand at the head while people leave. And then when it's carried out, you go in front of the pallbearers and lead it. In these times, the chief mourner, which would be the mother, would be leading the casket. So picture the crowd. Picture all these people who are paid, maybe not even to know the child's name, but they're paid to mourn. They're paid to throw dust in the air. They're paid to wail. They're paid to weep. And you hear all of this sound. People in the Middle East being explosive and expressive anyway. And you have all of this outpouring of the professional mourners. And then a crowd behind that. The casket, the mother, and Jesus steps forth with the disciples, with the crowd. He touches the casket and it stops. And that introduces us then to the third part, the miracle. The miracle. 13 through 15. And the first thing that happens as the casket stops, reading 13, the casket stops, and when the Lord saw her, he felt compassion for her and said, do not weep. Now stop, and actually the Greek says stop weeping. I mean, she was. It's a command to construct her in such a way to stop something that is going on. And I think you've got that noted in your margin, don't you? Yes, you've got stop weeping out in your New American Standard Bible. So it's not looking at the mother who's about to burst into tears. She is in tears. And the Lord comes along and he says, stop what you're doing. Those words may have been spoken 1,000 times. This is the only time that they're backed with reason. Couldn't the mother have said, when he said, stop crying, sir, why? This is my only son. What good reason would you give her? We might say that to her. What would you say? Lady, stop weeping. She turns around and says, would you please tell me why? Does that request have any ground in reason? And what would you say? It's all right. No, it's not all right. He'll be okay. No, he's dead. He'll rise from the dead. No, he won't. He's dead. And therefore, those are empty words, except, as a matter of fact, it would be, it'd be rude. Imagine stepping, would you like to do that at a funeral? Find the most bereaved, closest relative, the mother, and say, mother, would you please stop crying? Did you have the guts to do that? I wouldn't. Because there's no reason to say don't cry. In this particular case, there's a reason. It's the reason he says it is, I'm about to show you there is no occasion for tears. And that's what he will show in the following context. Now, one of the characteristics of things that Jesus did, acts and words are often glimpses of bigger things. And let me give you an example or two of that. My first example, without turning to it, would be this. Jesus took Peter, James, and John, went to the mountain, and he was transfigured in their sight, and it says that he, body appearance, glowed as the sun. What did that event of the transfiguration prefigure? Remember, according to 2 Peter, the transfiguration is a preview of Christ's second coming. So the transfiguration and what happened there, the act that happened there, was a glimpse of bigger things. In this context, the Lord is going to say to the man, young man, I say to you, arise, and he's going to rise. He will raise a dead man. That is a glimpse of bigger things. Look at John 5. John 5. Just treat it as a glimpse of a bigger thing. Raising of one man is the small glimpse. But notice how much bigger the whole thing gets if you go to the Gospel of John chapter 5. And oh, we're coming down to what, about verse 25. Truly, truly, I say to you, an hour is coming, and now is, when the dead shall hear the voice of the Son of God, and those who hear shall live. For just as the Father has life in himself, even so he gave to the Son to have life in himself. And he gave him authority to execute judgment because he's the Son of Man. Do not marvel at this, for the hour is coming in which all who are in the tombs shall hear his voice and shall come forth. So what have we got? We've got a mini picture in the raising of this man of the maximum picture. When he says to the mother, stop weeping, that is a mini picture of Revelation 21:4. Stop weeping is a mini picture of Revelation 21 and verse 4, which is the big picture. And Revelation 21:4 he, speaking of Christ, shall wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there shall no longer be any death, there shall no longer be any mourning or crying or pain. The first things have passed away. So, as we go throughout the life of Jesus in the Gospel of Luke, when you see him raise a man, it shows he has the power to raise all men. And when he dries the tears of a woman, it is prophetic of the day when he will dry the tears of all. And therefore, we have the principles, the acts and the words of Jesus are often glimpses of bigger things that are yet to come. All right, back to Luke 7. In verse 13, notice a remark about the emotion of the Lord. It says, when the Lord saw her, he felt compassion on her. That is kind of a, that's kind of a willy-nilly translation. You don't want to hear it literally? His heart went out to her. And that would be very accurate with you. When the Lord saw her, his heart went out to her. And he said, do not weep or stop weeping. Now, how does human sympathy and Jesus' sympathy compare? Well, let's just put a note on sympathy, dash, or sympathy, dash, man's, Christ's. How do they differ? Number one, human sympathy is often faked. Even in minor things, things we apologize for. How stricken are we when we step in front of someone and say, oh, I'm sorry. I don't know that the word sorry quite gets it. I'd rather say pardon me, but I don't know that I'm really... The word sorrow is a little bit heavy to say for something like that. How many times have all of us sitting here said, I'm so sorry to hear that you lost your mother? I remember saying that once. I'd gotten wrong information. I said, I'm sorry you lost your mother. And the person said, I haven't. Which showed how genuine I was. But it was the thing to say, at any rate. Human is often fake. But there's more to it than that. Human is always helpless, especially in the face of death. I'm sorry so-and-so died, but what can I do about it? All I can give is words. All I can say is I feel something. But I'm helpless to do anything, and therefore, what you have in the instance of Jesus, his heart went out, and it was not helpless, because it was divine sympathy in the fullest sense of the word. Now, there's a first here in verse 13. First time Luke ever uses it. Anyone see it? Might guess it. It's the first time Luke ever calls Jesus Lord. And so verse 13, when the Lord, Luke says, saw her. You have to give some kind of explanation. Why is this the first time that Luke calls Jesus Lord? And I take it the context supplies the reason why, is this man is facing the ultimate enemy. Christ may be Lord of leprosy, Lord of the lame, and Lord of diseases, but he is a Lord of death. Well, Luke apparently is struck, and for the first time he notes that he is Lord because he is Lord over the last enemy to destroy it, which is death. With that, he addresses the dead man, verse 14. He came up and touched the coffin. First observation, who asked the Lord to do anything in this miracle? So notice this is pure divine initiative. He was not asked to do anything. Is that surprising? Not really. Death is final. What is there to ask? What could he do? And therefore, again, notice this is purely the initiative of Jesus. No one asked for anything, and he then speaks to the dead man. Might note here, this is true in all three of the raisings in the New Testament. The first one is here, verse 14. The second is Luke 8:54, second incident. And the third is John 11:43. In all three cases, the Lord speaks to the dead person. As soon as he does that, we have the event, young man, I say to you, arise. And, you know, that is so far beyond human power, you just almost smile. I mean, it would probably be a good exercise in showing how human we are to slip by newcomers tonight and speak to the casket and say, sir, arise. They'll call the police. They'll take you away. Because this man is crazy. He talks to dead people and asks them to come out of the casket. Well, you can imagine the shock that was there as the coffin stops, and Luke apparently sees the drama of this. He came up, he touched the coffin. Well, notice the sequence of events. First, the mother stopped crying. He takes steps forward, reaches out his hand, stops, puts his hand on the coffin, and it stops. By then, you've got absolute silence. Young man, looking at the body in the coffin, I say to you, arise. And the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. What had the Lord just said to some of the disciples as they were fishing? Follow me. And they were asked to leave everything. Notice this is the reverse. It does not say the dead man sat up and began to speak, and Jesus said, follow me and I will make you fishers of men. He gave him back to his mother. Every restoration from death in the Bible is a restoration of a family tie. Everyone. Everyone is restoration. What about Lazarus? It was a restoration of a family tie to his sisters, and there are no exceptions to that. That's always the restoration as they were. This also shows the sincerity of his compassion toward the mother. If this man had followed the Lord, I imagine he'd been pretty zealous. If the Lord raised me from the dead, I think I would probably be pretty zealous too. But nonetheless, he did not. He gives them back to his mother. With that, you have the impact. And the impact is fourfold. Fear gripped them all. Fear usually has to do with respect and awe, and that goes without needing any explanation. They began glorifying God, saying, a prophet has risen among us, and God has visited his people. Now, in seeing this praise and this conclusion, don't get too carried away, because the response of the crowd that is found here, or we put it, I believe, did we not, the impact. Impact 7:16-17. First of all, and I don't mean to dampen enthusiasm, but notice, they did not say he's the prophet. They said he's a prophet. They said he's a prophet, not the prophet. So they've got a good concept, but it's not too thorough. Which means, as a prophet, they saw Jesus, in their view, was God's instrument or God's agent. And while that's true, that falls short, because Jesus is more than God's agent. He is God incarnate. Just to show that we don't get too carried away, go over to chapter 9 of Luke, verse 18. That this opinion, though spoken here, was by no means consensus. It doesn't mean they accepted him as the Messiah in a full sense of the word at all. Chapter 9, verse 18. It came about while he was praying alone, the disciples were with him, and he questioned them, saying, who do the multitudes say that I am? What's the consensus? What are people saying? And notice there was no consensus of his true identity. Verse 19, they answered and said, John the Baptist. Others say Elijah. Others, one of the prophets of old, has risen again. And the Lord says, but whom do you say I am? Peter answered, the Messiah of God. So we don't want to get too carried away in this chapter and think that the multitudes of people are all coming to a realization that Jesus is the Messiah. That is not the case at all. Now, closing observations. Observations on the raising of the woman's only son. I think the first one you're going to find surprising. Let me say it first, then we'll write it. The majority of all recorded raisings from the dead in the Bible were done for women. Point one. The majority of raisings of the dead were done for women. Now, I can substantiate that observation, and I will. But you might want to begin to think before we establish that this is really true. What would you want to say next? If we can establish that the majority of raisings were done for women, what's your question? Why? How do we explain this? What's the meaning of this? Now let's establish the point first by going back to 1 Kings. 1 Kings. Chapter 17, verse 17. We're looking at all the raisings. 1 Kings, chapter 17, verse 17. Now it came about after these things that the son of the woman, the mistress of the house, became sick, and his sickness was so severe, that there was no breath left in him. In other words, he died. At verse 23, Elijah took the child, brought him down from the upper room into the house, and gave him to his mother. And Elijah said, "See, your son is alive." Notice it was done for a woman and involved a woman. Here, a mother. 2 Kings 4. 2 Kings 4. This is in connection with Elisha. A woman has conceived, has born a son. In verse 18, when the child was grown, the day came that he went out to his father to the reapers, and he said to his father, "My head, my head," apparently crying in pain for some reason. And he said to his servant, "Carry him to his mother." And when he had taken him and brought him to his mother, he sat on her lap until noon and then died. So notice again the child and the mother involved. Verse 36. He, the prophet, calls Gehazi and said, "Call the Shunammite." That's the woman. So he called her. And when she came to him, he said, "Take your son." Then she went in and fell at his feet and bowed herself to the ground. And she took her son and went out. Notice the mother deeply involved. John 11. The third raising of Scripture, and notice the involvement of women. Chapter 11, verses 1 through 3. A certain man was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha, and it was the Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was sick. The sisters therefore sent to him, saying, "Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick." Notice it's a request of a sister. Verse 32. Therefore, when Mary came where Jesus was, she saw him and fell at his feet, saying to him, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." And you have verse 39. Jesus said at the tomb of Lazarus, "Remove the stone." And Martha, the sister of the deceased, said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be a stench, for he's been dead 4 days." And then he steps forward and says, "Lazarus, come forth." It was done in the interest of a woman. Acts 9. Acts 9. A woman has died, and in verse 39, says, Peter rose and went with them, and when they had come, they went to an upper room, and all the widows stood beside him weeping, and showing all the tunics and garments that Dorcas had used to make while she was with them. But Peter sent them all out, knelt down, prayed, turning to the body, he said, Tabitha, arise. She opened her eyes, and when she saw Peter, she sat up, and he gave her his hand, raised her up, and calling the saints and widows, he presented her alive to the saints and here to the widows. Hebrews 11:35. Speaking of some of the greats of the faith, it's an interesting remark that he makes in verse 35. Women receive back their dead by resurrection. And we pretty much now covered the ground then by going back to Luke, and in Luke noticing that when the man is healed or the son is healed, the dead man stood up, began to speak, and Jesus gave him back to his mother. So, is our observation accurate? And the answer is yes, it's provable. We read it. The majority of raisings of the dead were done for women. However, it leaves us with a why question. Have any ideas on a why question this might be? Let me give you mine. Would you feel strange if someone would say to you, Bob Smith gave birth to a son? If we said Carol Smith gave birth to a son, would that be strange? Well, one is very strange, the other is not, and I take it then, while we never speak of a man giving birth, we speak of a woman giving birth because of her peculiar involvement in the birth process. If a woman is intimately associated with death, what would the intimately associated with birth, what would the death of that one be? Wouldn't it be particularly painful to her? And doesn't that show a little bit about some generalizations we can make? And I know everybody today, it's one of the things we're going to cover in the weekend, has reduced male and female to indistinguishable entities. But isn't it generally true that your kid goes down the block and he gets beat up, and he comes home and mom and dad are both there? Are they going to react the same? Mom is going to clean him up. She's going to put some medication on. Her basic feeling will be mercy toward her son. What's dad thinking? He's a little more oriented, not to mercy, but he's a little more oriented to something called justice. And that is typical. That's one of the distinctions that God has built in, and we'll deal with it on this weekend coming up, is that there's a difference between men and women. It doesn't mean women are not just. It means they have a peculiarity of having an extra bit of mercy, and the man is more interested in going out on a campaign and fighting and busting noses in the interest of justice than he is in wiping noses. So I just make it as a suggestion then, is because of intimate association with birth, death is especially painful, and the Lord says, I want you women as women to know something. I can handle your very deepest problem. And therefore, I will establish in my word that I have a peculiar sympathy and identity with a mother's feelings. It's part of what we could call from the Old Testament the loving kindness and the compassion of the Lord. And it means I identify with our thoughts and our feelings. Second. Three observations, we may go a minute or two over here, but second, only Luke tells of more than one raising. Now, can you stop and think why that might be, or how that might be significant? There are three recorded raisings. Luke records two of them. Matthew, none. Mark, none. John, one. Luke, two. Considering the fact that Luke was a doctor, we could say that you have a little medical opinion here. Being a doctor, having been around and associated with sickness and death, who would be more impressed with a raising from the dead than the doctor? He just didn't didn't accomplish that in his practice every day, and therefore it shows Luke was a man who was truly impressed with the raising of the dead, and therefore records it more than any other. Third, take the Old Testament raisings and the raisings of Jesus and compare them. There is great contrast. There is great contrast between the raisings of the Old Testament and those of Jesus. It's a great contrast between the raisings of the Old Testament and those of Jesus. Let's look at one. 1 Kings 17. And what I want you to notice in these two passages is associated with the raising of the Old Testament was wrestling and struggle and difficulty and agony. 1 Kings 17, 20. And here's a raising. The son is given to Elijah. And notice how this comes about. Verse 20. He called to the Lord and said, O Lord, my God. The child is now laid before him. O Lord, my God, thou hast also brought calamity to the widow, with whom I am staying by causing her to die. Then he stretched himself upon the child three times, called to the Lord and said, O Lord, my God, I pray thee, let the child's life return to him. And you can see there was quite a procedure and a bit of almost begging and agony and stretching forth himself, and the child was raised. 2 Kings 4. We want to see the contrast between the raisings of the Old Testament through one such as a prophet and the raisings from the dead recorded of Jesus. 2 Kings 4, 32. And when Elijah came to the house, behold, the lad was dead and laid on his bed. So he entered and shut the door behind them both, prayed to the Lord. He went up, lay on the child, put his hand on his mouth and his eyes on his eyes and his hands on his hand. He stretched himself on him, and the flesh of the child became warm. Then he returned and walked in the house once back and forth, and so forth. And the child is raised. Now let's go back to Luke and close. Verse 14 of chapter 7. He, Jesus, came up and touched the coffin, and the bearers came to a halt. And like in the Old Testament, the Lord climbed in the coffin, stretched himself out on the body three times, seven times. He prayed. He said, this calamity has happened. Please do something. Not at all. Nothing like that, is there? He touches the coffin and he says, young man, I say to you, sit up. He sat up. Stands in front of Lazarus' tomb and says, Lazarus, out here. And he came forth. And you have an illustration then by means of contrast that Jesus is truly established by Luke 7 to be Lord of all things, including death. Father, we're thankful tonight for your word, for the person of Jesus Christ, for his power, for his ability. We're thankful for his compassion that's exhibited in this passage and for his sovereign control of all things, that he himself is sovereign over the last enemy, which is death. And he is in control and sovereign over it. For this we give you thanks in his name.